Good morning. We'll call the order of the meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee for Thursday, April 30th, 2009. We do have a quorum present. We have one bill on our agenda, Senate File 1126, Senator Maugham's bill on tax forfeited property uses and conveyance procedures modification. Senator Maugham, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you for indulging us and being willing to come back together after we've formally done our work. This is not a late introduction bill, although we kept it outside of the work of the usual course of trying to meet deadline, because ultimately the language that we're working on is going to end up in the tax bill. This bill has to do with tax forfeited land, and the Department of Revenue has been working very hard to try to help us, to come to us with some recommendations on how to resolve several issues that have raised, have come up over time with respect to tax forfeited land. And so this language of the bill as introduced was initially recommendations by the department to the tax committee and the tax policy bill. But because we felt that it was important to give an opportunity to other committees that had an interest in this area, an opportunity to look at the language and vet it, I worked with Mrs. Off, and we took the provisions, made it into a separate bill, and sent it through the various committees in the Senate. This bill has had a very thorough vetting in the Environment Policy Committee, because it, some aspects of it does concern conservation land. But today we come to the Judiciary Committee because I think that the processes that are involved, the reclassification, this bill is very much in the jurisdiction of this committee. We would like to have give an opportunity for the members to take a look at this. I had thought that we would lay it on the table, but I think that we will send it to the Senate floor, because the Rules Committee, when they met yesterday to send the bill to us, did waive the late bill requirements that we have to go back to the Rules Committee. So I'd like to send this bill to the floor, just keep our options open. Mr. Chair and members, the historically in the state, you know, the state, the counties have the, as has been designated, right, as the governmental entity that has the authority and the responsibility to manage property tax type issues. And historically, tax forfeited land has been held by the state in trust for the taxing, the local, the state, and other local taxing authorities, but it is the counties that manage these properties. And our tax forfeited land, I think, laws has been in operation since, I believe, 1941, or the mechanism that we're looking at today has been in operation since 1941. And under current law, local governments have a couple of choices about how it acquires tax forfeited lands from the state. One, they can pay full market value for it, and then they can use the land for any public purpose, economic development, or for whatever purpose they want. Or two, they can get the land for free on a conditional deed, but when they are given that deed, there are conditions that are attached to it, and they have to use it for the purposes of those conditions. Part of the problem is that since 1941, a number of the free conditional deeds have been given to local governments. And I don't want to be on the record in saying that it's been intentional on the part of local governments to mislead or to, you know, obtain these used deeds for free and then turn around and do use it for a different purpose. But we know that over time, I think, as county plans and city plans change over time, a parcel which local governments initially acquired, perhaps, that fit a public use purpose may change over time. I mean, from 1941 till now is an awfully long time in the interim. And so what our Department of Revenue has found is that as they started to look at this issue, some of the parcels that have been acquired by local governments by use deed has now falling out of compliance with those public purposes. And because of the numbers of these use deeds that are, that have been granted are out there, it would be, I think, administratively difficult, and it would not be a good use of our resources to try to track every parcel that we've granted a use deed for. And the condition is that if a local government who obtains this land for free with a conditional deed, if they use it for a purpose other than the public purpose that was stated, then the title reverts back to the state. And so not only do we have to follow up to enforce the conditional use to make sure it's appropriate, but then we would have to go in and basically act to get title to revert back to the state. And we just don't think that that's necessarily the most prudent thing to do at this point in time. So the Department of Revenue has come up with a proposal here to help us to deal with not only the use deeds that have been issued so far, but to also address the conditional use deeds moving forward, recognizing that it is a good thing. It is a good thing when we have tax forfeited land that the state is holding in trust, that it is a good thing for us to make it accessible and available to local government, but to do it with a mechanism that's transparent and where we can now continue to monitor it. So that's why we have this proposal before you. And I have a staff person from the Department of Revenue who has done all the work on this. He is an expert. He could probably speak about this in his sleep. He's going to speak a little bit to the work that he has done, just giving you some examples of why, you know, we felt that it was important to move forward. And then I have an amendment that has been brought to us by the Newspaper Association. You should know that when this language was initially proposed, there have been a number of gatherings with the local government, with county governments in the state to try to make the language work. And so we did put a delete everything amendment in the Environment Policy Committee as an author's amendment to really put the bill into shape. And the amendment that I will ask you to consider today is an amendment that the Newspaper Association has asked us to help them address the notice provision. But I would like to have Mr. Nord walk us through his presentation. And then in the discussion, I would like to come back and deal with the A3 amendment.
Sarah Maud, perhaps we're going to have the A3 amendment distributed so members
yes,
can take a look
please,
at it
Mr.
while we have the testimony. Any questions of the author? If none, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jason Nord. I'm a State Program Administrator Director at the Department of Revenue in the Property Tax Division. And I've kind of over-prepared a handout. This is kind of a hard issue to jump into and understand quickly and easily. So, but I'm not going to go through the entire handout. I've provided it more as a reference. If you have any questions about any of the slides that I don't cover, feel free and ask them or contact me at some point. But so I'm going to skip through the handout a little bit, and I'll start on page 4 with the bottom slide titled "Why Are Use Deeds a Pressing Issue?" For quite a while, you know, use deed compliance had been a bit of a latent issue, but recently we've started to see a number of issues popping up. Some counties have come to the Department of Revenue in their review of the use deeds that they've issued, and they've seen what they believe has been abandoned uses by some of the cities or towns. They've also come to us and identified what they believe were failure of cities or towns to establish the uses for which they took the use deed for. And then both the counties and the Department of Revenue have started to question one of the unique provisions of use deeds. There's an exception provided in with respect to the reverter clause for a use deed that says that if you sell the parcel under authority under Chapter 469, that the use you took the it for is not considered abandoned, which is a really awkward way of arranging a deed. So in other words, a city may take a parcel for a park, and then at some point they could sell it for housing development, and we're supposed to view that as not having abandoned the park use. And so it's kind of a very awkward way for title for that parcel to sit. And so and the department, not being an expert in the Chapter 469, often questions whether cities have the authority that they claim they have when they try to make sales under Chapter 469. So that's kind of an exception in the law that is a pretty significant exception that kind of distorts distorts the original intent of the law, at least as we see it. We've also had taxpayers coming to us and challenging the city's holding of land and arguing that that's their holding of the land or their transfer of property is not legitimate. We've also had prospective purchasers of tax forfeited lands who see a city or town holding land that they want to purchase, and they've asked us to look into the compliance with the use deed statutes. So with that, it might be best to jump to some of the examples. One of the things we did to try and get a better handle on use deed compliance was we thought, let's look back to 1983. It's been 25 years. Let's try and take a look at all the use deeds we issued in 1983 and see what the compliance rate is with those use deeds. And some of the cases that we encountered start with the pictures on page 6. In the end, we couldn't really come to a conclusion, and we kind of threw up our hands and quit on the project because it was apparent that a lot of times whether the parcel was in compliance or not was a very subjective, difficult thing to determine. So, for example, the top slide on page 6 is an example of a parcel that the city had acquired for public park purposes. And you can see from the aerial photo that essentially it's a low wetland. And, you know, it's certainly not what a common person might think of as a park. You wouldn't want your kids playing in the muck. You know, what is that a park? We've actually had a lawsuit that took us the last couple of years to resolve where a city had taken some lots similar to this as parks, and we tried to revert those parcels, saying that that was not a park. And the court, in its first decision, said that, you know, favored the city on those parcels. And then we appealed it. And so we now have a precedential decision where the court favored with the city, saying that in the city's city code, they had open space as part of their definition of a park. And since there's no definition of a park in state statute or in these statutes, they cited in favor of the city. And so given that precedential decision, we're almost inclined to call this a park now in cities that have that in their code, but not call it a park in cities that don't have that in their code, which is a very awkward thing for us to contend with. The next example is a little sliver parcel that was taken as road or right-of-way, and that's a landscaping business to the left there, and you can see that the monument, the sign that that identifies the landscaping business, is actually built on that sliver parcel. So certainly that's an example of non-compliance, and is an example of a number of cases that we ran into. On the top of page 7 is another example of a parcel that was taken as road or right-of-way. You know, it seems to us that there's space to the left and above the parcel that might be road or right-of-way, but it's hard to justify that parcel is being used for any road or right-of-way. So that's an example of non-compliance from a deed that was issued in 1983. The next example is actually on Lake Minnetonka. This parcel was taken to be used exclusively for wetlands and other public purposes. And you can see that people's docks are crossing that parcel, which would argue that perhaps it's being used privately and not being used publicly. I'm not an expert on where the high water mark is as to whether you can call that wetland or not, or whether that's private property, but certainly having to investigate that compliance and possibly revert that to the state because of the reverter clause is a very onerous task for us. On page 8, the top slide, is another example of just kind of a random parcel. It looks like a leftover. It's not being built on. It was taken as wetland preservation. It's certainly hard to see from that picture that there's any wetlands there. So the question is the expectation that the Department of Revenue go out and try and identify whether that's a wetland or not and revert it back to the state? Or is this a parcel that the city should be able to acquire through some other mechanism? We believe that a lot of these parcels are acquired through the use deed provision, mainly because that's the free way to acquire the parcel rather than having to pay full market value. If you have to pay full market value, it's very difficult for cities to be able to afford to acquire those parcels. But perhaps a parcel like that is better managed by a city than having to be managed by a county. So we believe that there should be other alternatives for cities to acquire property with a better title. The bottom example on page 8 is a 5-acre parcel that was taken back before the housing in that area had been developed, and it was taken as a stormwater holding area. Well, after the development occurred, it's clear that there is some stormwater holding on a portion of that parcel, but it's only about an acre of the parcel that's being used for stormwater holding. The other 4 acres of the parcel could easily be developed for a very nice home. And so that was one of the questions we ran into. The other extreme example would be, what if a city took a 40-acre parcel for a water tower? Certainly you don't need 40 acres for a water tower. So how are we supposed to judge compliance when only a fraction of a parcel is being used for the intended use?
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Shai?
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask, is it Mr. Nord? Is it?
Yes.
If I might ask him, and I've kind of forgotten what I was going to ask, it was about the 40 acres and the water tower.
You need 40 acres for a water
tower? And when, at the time, the local government acquires that parcel from the state, is that when the purpose is set out? Could there have been other purposes in an original deed?
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, the law provides that the Department of Revenue shall not, when you take a use deed, the law asks that the Department of Revenue not investigate that in the first 3 years. So we have to essentially give them 3 years to establish their use, and then at the 3-year point we do a check. And unfortunately, in the past, our checks have not been rigorous because of resources. So we'll write the city a letter saying, hey, did you ever make this a water tower? They say, yeah, we did. So then we move on.
Sorry, you could have called me. I would have gone and checked.
Oh.
No. So, all right, I know that this, I'm looking at the public purpose, and I'm thinking of actual, original deeds when land is platted, and that sometimes that language causes problems because of where that land for public purpose is situated, and it may be between homes or cabins and a lake, mm-hmm. and... it also presumes that somebody knows whether or not, if that's supposed to be a stormwater holding area, it probably has some water issues. And so how do you say, well, a house should be built there when maybe it should be the swamp, what we call the swamp when I was young, that looked a lot like that area that you said was a park, and we built a raft and used to go that on the top of page 6, we actually did play in a swampy area around Minnehaha Creek in St. Louis Park. And, we got a tree limb and pushed ourselves around on a raft. So, it could be that, Or I'm thinking of some other nature areas where people have built walkways and people can go there and watch birds and other critters. So... I'm just concerned about how we decide whether or not they're complying, or we just kind of make an eyeball judgment.
Mr. Nord?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I agree it's very difficult to determine compliance. As the Department of Revenue, our role is not to manage tax-forfeited lands. That's the role of the county. Our role is simply to issue deeds, and so for us to be responsible for, jointly with the county, trying to determine compliance is the main reason why we decided to look into reforming and limiting the use deed as a mechanism.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to say that I have some really strong concerns about this proposal. Where I come from, this tax forfeited land, which is most often just referred to as county land, is a huge part of what people consider their public property. And so my question is, first of all, it doesn't look to me like there's any provision to have to give notice to the public generally, or other than on the web page or in the surrounding landowners.
Mr. Chair, I knew that we would generate discussion in this committee,
And so if maybe the committee members would be patient. Mr. Nord is just building the case for why the Department of Revenue felt it's important for us to do something because of these issues. And I've asked him to, because the conversation is going in that direction, to go through what we're proposing in the bill. And I think that would answer some of your questions, Senator Olson. We're not doing anything that's bad, but we're proposing a mechanism to better manage it. So this is not to put in place something that's going to take away people's tax forfeited land or anything like that, but putting a mechanism in place so that we can be more efficient and more helpful in managing that tax forfeited land. And so why don't we have Mr. Nord go through what the bill is proposing to do, the mechanism, and then we'll look at the A3 amendment, which deals with public notice. And then if you still have big problems with the bill, we can talk about how we can help.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Nord, do you want to continue?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I go through, I'm going to skip now to page 12 and start going through the sections. You can either look along on the bill itself or follow my slides that start on the bottom of page 12. But one thing to keep in mind as I go through this is a lot of the reaction we get to these proposals are actually reactions to not being too keen with current law and so we're not creating use deeds by any means. We're trying to clean them up, so to speak. So this is kind of an issue that it takes a little bit of time to sink in. But so a lot of the reaction we get initially are truly reactions to current law, and we're doing our best to address those. So with that, in Section 1 of the bill, the first thing we're doing is we're striking a whole bunch of language and to give you and we're kind of reshuffling that into some new paragraphs and organizing it a little bit better. The first thing we're doing is moving and clearing language that allows lands to be reclassified from time to time after their initial classification. That's in paragraph C. In paragraphs C and D, what we're doing is we're replacing the current law's process by which the county decides to classify the land, and then that classification decision is either approved or denied by the city or town. That can, from time to time, create stalemates. And so we're where if the city or town doesn't agree with the classification, nothing happens with it in perpetuity until they get some agreement. So we're replacing that methodology of classifying lands with a new methodology in paragraphs C and D that invites open public comment from all affected jurisdictions and any interested parties to inform the county of what their ideas are with regard to that parcel before the county makes the classification decision. Now, other counties have had quite a bit of success and a good relationship with their local governments in using the current law practices and weren't quite as keen on the new practices. And so starting with paragraph F and then G, H, and I, we have the alternative to revert back to the current law practice and we've addressed the stalemate issue by saying if they run into any stalemates, they have to use the new practice in classifying lands. We also move, we replace some language that talks about lands being withheld from sale. Cities or towns can ask that a parcel can be withheld from sale, and they can continually renew this six-month hold. And so we've stricken that here and added new language in Section 2 to deal with that. We also move language into the new paragraph E that talks about the combining and subdividing of tracts and land. That's authorized under current law. We clarify that you cannot subdivide tracts of tax forfeited lands in order to circumvent the restrictions in 282.018 subdivision 1, which is the restriction that says that if a parcel has so many feet of lakeshore that you have to receive legislative approval to sell the parcel. So we don't want people to subdivide those parcels to circumvent the statute. We don't know if that's been an issue or not. We're trying to get ahead of the curve there. So then in Section 2 of the bill, the first part under paragraph A is that new process for requesting the parcel be withheld from sale so that local governments can explore the opportunity of purchasing the property. Paragraphs B and C separate the ability to purchase non-conservation lands for both. Paragraph B is for local governments. Paragraph C deals with state agencies. Also, in paragraph B, we're clarifying the term market value. One of the concerns is, what does value mean under current law? Does it require a formal appraisal? Is it solely the discretion of the county board to set the value? We've tried to clarify that value means market value, but that it doesn't require a formal expensive appraisal. So it's up to the county board to identify market value. Then we create new authority in paragraph D that allows counties to sell tax forfeited lands for less than market value. So this gets around the need to always have to jump to a use deed to get discounted land prices. But we want to be somewhat reserved in providing that authority. So we're trying to limit it to the provision of affordable housing or the correction of blight. So rather than just any economic development project or a market economic development project, being able to take a use deed, use the exception to acquire the land, we instead give some explicit authority to acquire land cheaply for valued economic development purposes. We also then in paragraph E get to our major reforms of what use deeds can actually be used for. And the first thing we try to do is put some definition around what a public use is, what that means. And we'd say that it means that it's a use that allows an indefinite segment of the public to physically use and enjoy the property in numbers appropriate to its size and use, or for a public service facility. And then we specifically limit it to a list of authorized public uses, and that list being roads, parks. We do not explicitly and completely define parks, but we do try to put some more parameters around it by saying that the parks must contain, available to and accessible by the public, because not every parcel has been, and also that it contains some amenities, whether it be campgrounds, trails, ball fields, at least some form of amenity. Trails, transit ways, beaches, public parking, civic and conference facilities, public service facilities such as police stations, fire stations, water towers are the list that we came up with.
And Mr. Nord and members confirmed this, that list actually expands on the, and it's more true to the definition of public use than what current law is. So it's actually making current law better, correct?
Correct. Well, Mr. Chair, yes, Senator Moi, that is correct. It is a little more restrictive than current law, because current law, they've been taking use deeds for drainage, for a whole variety of things, including economic development outright, given the exception that's in the law. So this is a curtailing of what we would issue use deeds for.
Mr. Chair. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, one of the very biggest uses in northern Minnesota of this type of land is for hunting. And you don't want amenities on hunting land. And that's considered an important use by a very large segment of the population in this state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, perhaps to clarify some of the more, the northern areas of the state where there's a large volume of tax forfeited lands, it's important to note that there's a distinction. When the county classifies the property, they either classify it as conservation lands or non-conservation lands. And most of these reforms address what you can do with non-conservation lands, because it's the non-conservation lands that can be sold or can be acquired through a use deed. The conservation lands are retained and managed by the counties, and those might be the types of lands that you're thinking of. And so this proposal does not prevent or limit or interrupt the ability of counties to maintain conservation lands.
Sir Olson?
Mr. Chair, I thought that Mr. Norden, I thought there was something in this about the county's ability to change that classification.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, that's also in current law. So that, say the county initially classifies something as non-conservation, and then they're persuaded that, no, it should be conservation land, they can revisit it and reclassify it. Or if it had been classified as conservation, they can revisit it and reclassify it as non-conservation. That's a feature of current law that we're not really changing.
Well,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Norden, I guess I would differ with what I've heard so far in terms of you not changing it. It sounds to me like you're allowing that reclassification to take place in a, and I don't see where that was there before, and I don't see where you have to give any notice to the surrounding neighbors or the public generally.
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Olson, the original language regarding reclassification is found in the stricken language on line page 2, lines 4 through 6. And actually what we've tried to do is create more process around the classification, not less process. So we are requiring that counties have a meeting where they can solicit and notify people that the meeting's going to occur, that the classification's going to occur. We believe we're trying to make that a more open and visible and transparent process, and are certainly not interested in limiting that or changing that in a negative way.
Okay, why don't you continue going through the bill?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, if I just might, it looks to me like the county board could kind of do this in a vacuum, and you have 60 days under current law to challenge their reclassification, whereas this, I think the new language then at the bottom of page 2 and going forward sets up the meetings that they have to have, and I assume that that's what the amendment pertains to as well, and giving notice to people of the meeting. So, I mean, I think it clearly is establishing a more public process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, that's our intent. That's what we're trying to accomplish. And so if there are better ways for us to do it, or if there's anything we're missing, and certainly we've all throughout this process, we've welcomed people's concerns and done our best to address them, because the Department of Revenue isn't necessarily married to any specific outcome. The only thing we really want to achieve is greater clarity and a law that we can administer. And we don't think that current law is very clear or easy to administer in any way. And so, you know, the policy directions, the Department of Revenue doesn't really have a huge stake in the fight. We're mainly out for clarity and better administration, more efficient administration. So we've been very receptive and tried to incorporate concerns from a number of angles, and we'll continue to do so. And I think Senator Ma has been very open to that as well. So continuing then with Section 2, Paragraph E was the better description and provisions of use deeds. Paragraph F is new authority that allows a county to convey parcels for free that were deeded to local governments as part of a development agreement. So this is your developer outlots, where the developer was supposed to give a parcel, an outlot, to a city. They failed to do so. They let the property forfeit. Under current law, the city would then either have to pay full market value or try to rationalize a use deed for it. And so this just allows the county to give those parcels to the city to which they were intended. And paragraph G does a very similar thing in allowing the county to transfer to common interest communities lands that they can show that they were entitled to receive prior to forfeiture. Moving on to new paragraph H, this creates a new authority. This is a provision that does deal with conservation lands rather than non-conservation lands. Cities have made good arguments that sometimes they might be in a better position than the county to manage tax forfeited lands that are conservation lands. This allows, if the county is willing, the county can sell to a city for less than market value conservation lands for the purposes of creating or preserving wetlands, for drainage or stormwater management under a stormwater management plan, or for preservation or restoration and preservation of land in its natural state. And so there certainly may be times when cities can particularly with regard to drainage parcels, cities might be in a better position to do that than counties. This facilitates a clean transaction of title in those circumstances. Section 3 deals with targeted neighborhood lands. Initially, we had repealed this, but we have changed our mind on that. Targeted neighborhoods are mainly, I believe, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and there's a special provision that allows cities to acquire those for free is how they currently receive them. And we are only limiting, the only thing we're doing with this change is we're trying to clarify, because there was some confusion whether the targeted neighborhood deeds were supposed to be quitclaim deeds or whether they were supposed to be some kind of hybrid use deed. And so we're clarifying by striking paragraph B and by adding language about quitclaim deeds. We're trying to clarify that. We're also restricting it just to cities of the first class because we've heard there's other efforts out there to greatly expand the more global targeted neighborhood land laws. And rather than having this type of an exception proliferate into other cities, we'd like to limit it to the first class cities. Then section four basically just updates references and clarifies that the reversion occurs by operation of law. It's been our position that, for example, if you took a parcel for a park and then built housing on it, even if we don't notice it till 30 years later, the parcel reverted back to the state when the use was abandoned, not, you know, when we find out about it and kind of process the paperwork. So that's a clarification of that interpretation.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
Chairman, may I just ask, is targeted neighborhood lands defined someplace else? In another section, maybe subdivision 1A or something? Or is
it Mr. Norda?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, yes, on line 7.13, we reference the definition for that.
So what Senator is that? Scheid. I mean, is this a blighted neighborhood or is it?
Mr. Norda.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I am not completely up to snuff on what those parameters are. I believe it has to do with there are a number of different benchmarks below the poverty level. I don't know what all the criteria are.
Okay, I guess I can look it up. Okay.
Sorry, I should have that, and I didn't. I was meaning to pull that.
Yes, Sir Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Norden, I have a hard time with the part you just read about it reverting back automatically. And it just seems to me that I really question if anyone's really looked at or studied what that might do to upset where we are right now with, you know, with what might have happened 100 years ago. So you have something that was taken for a railroad. Who knows, you know? And that use has been abandoned, and since then all kinds of things could have happened to the land, and people have a lot of money invested. And the whole neighborhood has developed based on what has evolved since that point. Now you're going to put a cloud on the title of everything there and change something retroactively that may have evolved into an entirely different use with good purpose, just how things happen. I mean, life and the world changes. If it was a legitimate use at the time, there was an opportunity to question that. We have a legal process for that at the time. To go back and retromatically and especially automatically cause that kind of a cloud, I think is just, I wonder if anyone's even thought through how much land that might involve and what that could potentially do to an already difficult real estate market.
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I completely agree with you, but that's our interpretation of current law. That's why use deeds are such a problem is, you know, we've issued between 7,000 and 9,000 use deeds since 1941. We don't have exact numbers because, you know, most of our records prior to the mid-90s are on microfilm and in drawers, so we can't come up with an easy tally. We believe that there are probably hundreds of cases of clouded title right now because a lot of times cities and towns, you know, it doesn't say on the deed, this is a use deed, look at the reverter clause down below. They're kind of subtle. I don't know that everybody fully appreciates when a deed is a clear, quitclaim deed and when it's a use deed. And that's the biggest problem with use deeds. And that's why when there's so much pressure for local governments to try and acquire free land and acquire it through the use deeds, that just perpetuates the title problems and proliferates exactly the concern that you raised. And that's why we want to really limit what you can get a use deed for. For the more permanent uses like a park or a road, things that maybe don't change as much so that stuff can be better tracked. But the law as it sits says that you get title to the property only for as long as you're putting it to the use you took it for. And that's why it's our interpretation that under current law that reverter occurs by operational law. So this is not trying to change current law. This is just trying to affirm that was the intent from the 1940s. And certainly I agree. I'm not a fan of that as well.
But, Mr. Chair, for Senator Olson's benefit, we do recognize that some use deeds that were issued maybe 30 years ago now may have clouded title. And so what we're trying to do here is that the clarification for the reversion is prospective as we're looking at this, is prospective, taking into consideration the mechanisms that we've put into this bill. And it is our hope that by doing this, we're encouraging local governments and counties as they manage the different parcels to make sure that moving forward, whether it's by use deed or by quick claim deed, that the title to those parcels moving forward are now cleared and clean and not clouded. But we do provide a mechanism for those use deeds that have been issued, you know, those 7,000 to 9,000 use deeds that have been issued, where there could potentially be a clouding of that title. We do provide a mechanism to hopefully clear it up over time. And so Mr. Nord is going to talk about that, and then we can come back to your concern.
And so what is the process? I mean, if somebody's doing a, say, title examination for some property down the road and runs into one of these things and realizes that somehow it must have automatically reverted to the state because it wasn't being used for housing instead of what it was intended for, what do they do? Go to the court? Go to the legislature? How do they clear it up then? Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, I might defer to our staff attorney on that. He's had to deal with some of those cases in the past. I know he's worked with the attorneys involved to work on clearing up title, but I'm not exactly sure.
Mr. Chair, can Mr. Nord talk about the grandfathering and then moving in forward?
Okay.
Then we're done with the bill, and I'll have
sure.
the attorney come up and run through that scenario
okay.
So that we bring the whole bill together.
Sure. Mr. Nord, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we're getting to some of these issues in Section 5 now. So a lot of Section 5 is clarifying some of the terms. We also repeal in on the lines 819 through 828 is where we're eliminating the current economic development exception language that we've replaced with the process for purchasing at less than market value for blight, removal, and affordable housing back in Section 2. We're then making some clarifications there, too, as to what kind of information is sufficient for our three-year check that we do. A lot of times we've had people who aren't quite putting it to use yet, but it's in their formal plan. They're waiting to acquire one last parcel to make the use. And so we're allowing future uses to satisfy the three-year check as long as they're in a formal plan of the city. Then in the bottom slide on page 16 or it's paragraph B, starting on page 8, is where we start to get into how we're addressing some of the legacy issues. The first provision says that for any deeds that are issued before January 1st of 2006, in other words, deeds that are coming up for their three-year check this year, if after 15 years they've shown that they've met their use for which they took it for, they can exchange the deed if the county is willing for a more permanent quitclaim deed. That way we kind of cut to the chase and clear up title. We're also making provisions in paragraph D, most notably, to put a 40-year sunset on the reverter restriction. For properties that are more than 40 years old, we don't want the reverter clause to expire immediately without any opportunity for counties and cities to discuss noncompliance issues. So we're saying that that the reverter clause will expire at the later of 40 years after the deed was executed or 2015. So that gives a few years here for counties and cities to talk about the compliance of some of their older deeds. And then we won't have perpetual everlasting reverter clauses in deeds, and they'll expire after the 40 years. So then in Section 6, we are establishing an application fee for the use deeds. These are very onerous for us to administer, and we also want to encourage greater discretion in acquiring use deeds. So we're asking for a $250 fee with the application. We'll refund $150 of that if the application is denied, but that helps us to be able to manage these deeds, and it provides a little bit of gatekeeping. Then most of Sections 7, 8, 9, and 10 are mostly all pretty technical language cleanup and deleting of old provisions. The first kind of real substantial issue that we get to is in Section 11. If you look at Section 11 on page 15, The current law says that even for these sliver parcels, as we call them, these irregular parcels, they have to be purchased at no less than market value. We're changing that to say that they may be sold for less than market value. A good example of that is if the extension of your backyard happens to be a public use deed parcel that they've taken for open space or something, even though you mow it, you play on it, your kids, you know, run around on it, it may be a tax forfeited land that is under that the county has to manage, and they try to sell it to the neighbor, and the neighbor said, "Well, I don't want to pay property taxes on that, and I don't want to pay you, you know, $5,000 for that parcel, so no, thank you." Whereas if the counties have a little bit greater discretion to encourage the neighbors to pick up those sliver parcels, say, "Hey, we'll sell it to you for a dollar," that gets it off the county's role of lands that they have to manage, and kind of helps, I think, probably with liability issues as well, and helps get some of these sliver parcels off the county managed inventory. And then the Section 12, again, is a little more technical change. And then in the repealer, we're the first the three subdivisions that we're repealing under 282.01 are just repealing some obsolete statutes that had to do with land exchanges, I think, back in 1942. But the we are repealing 383A.76, which is a Ramsey County statute, but it allows cities in Ramsey County to, at their own decision, change the use of a use deed without any kind of review or approval at all. And most of the rest of the provisions of that section are kind of replaced by the new authority that we've created under these laws. And so our view is that that statute is no longer needed and is obsolete, or anything that isn't obsolete is probably not too desirable. So we're repealing that. And so that's the body of our reform proposal.
Any questions of Mr. Nord or the author?
Mr. Chair, do you still need a response to your question?
I would. Let me describe why I'm thinking of it. In my district in the city of Moundsview, we had some land that MnDOT had actually given over to the city years ago for public purpose. It was used as a golf course. It was never profitable. And at some point, Medtronic came in, and they wanted to purchase the property to build a building on, which is sitting there right now. And, of course, a Medtronic facility is not a park. So we actually had to come to the legislature, and I carried the bill to get the reverter done to the, you know, to get rid of that use as a public park. Ultimately, MnDOT intervened, and they said, "Well, hold on. We don't want it just to revert. We want like $1 million if you're going to go ahead with this deal." So I actually got caught up in some negotiations, not only to clear the title, but into figuring out how much to pay MnDOT for not using it as its purpose. So I don't know if this clears up you know, some of those issues, but we spent quite a bit of time trying to resolve those.
Mr. Welcome Chair.
Committee, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lance DeRica. I work with the Department of Revenue Legal Services. A couple of things to say. I'll try to keep it short. First of all, one situation that I was involved with was use deeds in particular. The property had, as Mr. Nord kind of described generically, been given to the city. I can't remember exactly what the purpose was. Let's say a park. And some years later, the city sold the property, I believe, to a developer who had some private houses on that. We discovered this some 20 years later. I'll try to keep this plain and simple. I don't want to get bogged down in legalities, but I'm not trying to hide anything. So if you want to know more, feel free. The basic way we solved that situation was to have the city convey the property back. The city had gotten the property from the use deed, and kind of our theory was there was no more legitimate conveyances after that because the city didn't have the authority to convey it to the developer. So the city, in order to paper over that situation, we unwound the first transaction and did a new one. The city conveyed it back to the state. That put it back into forfeited status. We could have done a reversion where we filed the paperwork to make it clear to everybody that it had reverted to the state. Then we're back to square one, and as Mr. Nord explained, this property can either be acquired by paying for it or through a use deed. So the simple solution is make sure it's clearly back in the hands of the state, then make sure there's a clean transaction from the state to the city, for market value, then it's the city's property. They can do with it whatever they're authorized to do with it, and then I think they conveyed it to the developer. So we unwind the first transaction and do a new transaction. This has come up a couple of three times in my tenure, and those are is the general terms of how we solve that. Mr. Chair, you also mentioned the aspect of a special law. We often suggest that as an alternative when we're going through these processes because, as you alluded to, mechanically, as a lawyer, you can get this stuff done. But at this point, the city, the developer, the people living, you got 3, 4, or 5 parties involved, much like the golf course in MnDOT. So the mechanics can be done. A special law can be done. Another aspect of these situations is that you've got a lot of people that have things at stake that aren't always easy to solve politically or policy-wise, but there is a mechanism to address these situations.
Mr. Chair, what is clear is that we want to be very intentional that this is an issue and that it's not a gotcha, but that the state very much would like for us to be affirmative about how we address this and being willing to be creative and thoughtful and use whatever avenues available for us to try to resolve it so that the properties are on the market, the properties are in use, and that the title is clean and clear and not clouded for future purposes. And I think this proposal is just trying to do that to the best that we can. And I'm not saying that it is the solution, but I also think that it takes us a whole lot further than where we're at under current law. And this doesn't mean that we won't need to come back in future years and tweak it. But it sure is, I think, a lot better than it is at current law. Mr. Chair, I wonder if we could put the A3 amendment on the bill and then have a discussion.
Well, we have the A3 amendment passed out. There is a technical change that needs to be made on page 1, line 9, where it says line 20. It actually should be line 27. That was just
7. Just line 27.
7.
Line 7. Line 7. Okay. Instead of line 20, just say 7. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 amendment, and I will incorporate in that change.
Well, and you'll have to describe it since this is not the committee of origin. Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, as usual, I have issues with the official newspaper of the public body, which in the big cities are two legal newspapers. And it looks to me like the people that you're trying to give notice to are not folks who are likely to read those legal newspapers. And would instead read the local government's website, which I see the original language has, and I think it stays there, or the general the general interest newspaper, general circulation newspaper. So I'm just curious about why we think we need to publish it in the legal newspapers when that's not the group of people that we're talking about the residents and all those other people, not the attorneys in the community.
Mr. Chair?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Sandy Nair, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Let me explain what the purpose of this amendment is. The bill as originally introduced simply provided notice of this county board meeting by posting it on a local website or electronically letting somebody know if they had electronic access. It did not provide for notice in any other way. It appeared to us that this was a special meeting of the county board, and there is already a process in place in Chapter 13D for notifying people who want notice of special meetings of local government. The language that you see in those two sentences in the A3 amendment come right out of Chapter 13D and is the current law for notifying people of special meetings. What it says is that you must mail or deliver a copy to or a notice to anybody who wants notice which can be done electronically if they have electronic access. If they don't, they can fax it, they can mail it, or whatever. So that is the process that's currently in place for notifying people of special meetings. There is no publication requirement. What the second sentence says is, at the discretion of the local body, if they have hundreds of people who sign up and want notice mailed to them or delivered to them, the local government has the option instead to publish it in a newspaper. This is not a mandate to publish in the newspaper. This is an option for the local governments to use publication if they do not want to incur the cost of mailing notice to hundreds of people who may have put their name on the list at their local, at their own option. So that's what this language is. The two sentences are right out of Chapter 13D and are the current law for noticing special meetings of county boards.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Higgins.
If hundreds of people have signed up for these notifications and you put the notice in the legal newspapers, none of them will see it unless they happen to be an attorney or they happen to work for another local government or something. That's my point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, current law also requires all newspapers who publish notices to not only put it in their print media, but it also mandates that they put it on the newspaper website.
Yes,
that is law in Minnesota. So it does not just go in print media. It does go on their website. And newspaper websites are widely read. When people go to the web for their news, they tend to go to newspaper websites and not to government websites. The other reason you may want to consider adding this language is not many, but the number of counties don't have websites at all.
I'm back to the same thing. It's not likely, Ms. Nairn, that people in their general daily reading of newspapers are going to pull up the Finance and Commerce or the Legal Ledger website any more than they would likely see it in the print version.
My
point is the general circulation newspaper should be where it goes, not to a specialty newspaper. That's my point. My other question.
And that's the current open meeting law,
by
the way.
I'm sorry.
That's the current open meeting law, by the way. Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chair, and I would just, I have some similar related, at least, concerns to what Senator Higgins is saying. You know, if you were to pick up any rural newspaper and look at the classified ads to do with real estate, you'd see that about half of them, well, a large percentage of them will list when they're in any proximity to public land as a big selling point. It's very important to people to have borders adjacent to public land or where they are in proximity to that land. It has a lot to do with the value of their land, and it has a lot to do with the quality of life for people when they buy that land. Now, when we have variances that happen affecting people's surrounding area, we have to give notice to those people who are impacted. I can't imagine anybody, first of all, even knowing that there's this requirement in law that there's, unless you're a newspaper, that you're supposed to file a special request that you be notified. I mean, the general public just isn't even going to know that exists. And they don't go on websites to be scanning them to see if there's some property that might be affected in their area. I mean, I'll give you an example of something that's happened back in my district this year. We have some property that was taken by eminent domain, so I guess that's different than tax-forfeited land, but apparently it has some similar restrictions about use. The DNR says it's part of a hatchery. Person who wants to buy that land says they're not using it for its original purpose, so they have an argument about that. So this person's gone to their legislator and introduced some language that specifically requires the DNR to sell the land, and the whole neighborhood and county and township and everyone is up in arms, and they never even had noticed this was happening. I didn't even know as a legislature where this is happening until it was already in someone's bill. I just think we have to be very careful about public land that the public is using for any purpose or thinking of as public land for any purpose and make sure people get adequate notice and an opportunity to. And I understand, Senator Moy, you're saying maybe we didn't even have that in the law before and you're trying to make it better. But this is a really big deal to people, this public land and what happens to it, making sure they have notice.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I mean, if that's what's your concern,
then you really ought to like this proposal. Because I can count on both hands how many times Senator Pearsall has in this committee talked about how arbitrary local communities have been treated by the various authorities, whether that's the watershed district or, you know, the counties or the whatever, in terms of their relationship with the neighborhoods and the people who are affected by these land use decisions. And I think that that current law basically says the county gets to make the reclassification, forwards their recommendation to the city or the affected town or city, and then the town or city gets to approve or disapprove. And if there's an issue, then it just kind of lays, it just hangs out there in no man's land. No notice, no public discussion. And what we've provided here is that there has to be an open meeting process with notification to the public, and that we have to allow comments from persons or agencies at the meeting, and that then we put in place a process for how you address the land that is under discussion. I think that this improves it tremendously from a public process from what it used to be. And so it's my hope that this process, however imperfect it may be as is proposed, I mean, work with me on how we make the process more accessible and friendly to the neighborhoods, but don't not like the bill, because the bill is trying to do exactly what you're talking about, which current law doesn't provide, and that's an ability for the people who are most affected by this to have input. The current law does not allow for that. And if for people like you and Senator Pearsall and others who are concerned about the public and neighborhoods not being involved and in allowed to be engaged in the process, you want to talk to me about how we do this and we do this right.
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And in as Senator Ma was saying, in building more process around this, one of the things that was important to us was we thought it was appropriate to provide 60 days a notice before the meeting, because it could actually be a regular county board meeting where this is taken up, or it could be a special meeting. We don't provide specific instructions in that regard, but having a 60-day notice to let cities or towns or any other interested entity to be able to evaluate their interest in that property, that 60 days was important to us. We don't really have a policy position as the department on whether it should be published in a newspaper or a mailed notice, but we are a little concerned that the 10-day issue of the publish, so you could instead of mailing notice, just publish it 10 days before. We do have a little bit of concern with that being too short of a time frame, but certainly the issue as to whether mailed notices or published notices are better, we don't have an opinion on, but we would like to see whatever the form of that notice is be a little more than 10 days.
Mr. Chair?
Sarah Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Wah, I very much appreciate what you said, and I actually appreciate that you're bringing this whole thing into the open for discussion, because it seems like just from this one experience I was describing that there are some real potential concerns for, and I think the more pressure we have from developers and others on what has been thought of traditionally as public land, the more important it is that we have some guidelines and some... so we don't have abuses, and so the public can weigh in. But I would just suggest, rather than basing this on those who have asked for notice, which I think is designed mainly for newspapers, that we have something that the public is more likely to get to see, which would be making sure that the affected landowners have notice, sort of like we do when we have people requesting a variance. And also that we have notice in the generally read newspaper that the public, you know, just like we do when we have mortgage foreclosure notices or whatever.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I had just written down basically what Senator Olson had said. Usually the property owners within 350 feet of the affected parcel must be given notice. Sometimes for rezoning or variances, you actually have to like put a notice on the property itself. I think those things are good provisions that we should maybe include in here. But I think that on the A3 amendment, lines 9 through 13 should be deleted. And, Mr. Chair, I'll move that.
Is that
Perhaps as a better course, maybe we can just divide the amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And just vote on them separately. So I think if we just between 1.8 and 1.9, just divide that out. Do we need to?
I wasn't trying to get it.
Okay. I think then we just vote on them separately.
That's
I think
fine.
That's what. Yeah.
Sarah. And then maybe Ms. Pontius can work on some language about giving written notice to owners of parcels within 350 feet and posting the property.
Is that law now? Or, Sarah Scheid.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know about that, but I agree that I think people who live around this, whether or not they've notified the board that they're interested, because they may not even know that it's public land, particularly if they're a new homeowner or something. But I do have a question, and Senator Higgins and I were kind of talking about whether or not this was just at a special meeting, which the amendment seems to be drawn to special meetings, but online. And the bill, 3.8 through 3.10, it says they can classify or may classify or reclassify at any regular or special meeting. So I think you need to, I don't know, maybe you only want to notify for special meetings, but I don't think so.
Mr. Chair?
Is there more?
There is a, what the bill is trying to do is to, and I understand what the A3 amendment is also trying to address, which is what we all want, which is as much notice as possible. So I think that at the end, our goals are the same. I really appreciate the Newspaper Association coming forward to say, you know, we think that just notifying on the website, I mean, it doesn't get to people who don't have computers. I mean, so I think that their intention here is very good, which is how do we broaden the notice? And you're right that maybe this is too narrowly drawn to special meeting. When we put the provision in place, we want it to be at a regular meeting. We don't want our local governments to have to do a special meeting to just deal with this, but that we wanted to build in the efficiency so that they can do it at a regular meeting. Part of the reason why I was comfortable with the different notice provisions going forward is that, and I'm operating on not enough information, and I'm willing to do a little bit of research, is that I do believe that under current local governments and cities and towns and cities and counties, they do have a notice process in place, you know, for land use type issues. So I don't know about, I mean, it may vary from local government to local government, but I know that in my county or in my city, particularly for land use or zoning type issues, I get a little postcard if it's within a certain area. So, you know, some of this may be that and maybe the League of Cities can help us do a little bit of research and come back. If you're willing to have me work on this with the intention that we want to create the broadest and the most intentional notice as possible to the people and the neighborhoods who are affected by it. I would be satisfied if the counties and the cities would say to us, yes, that's the current process we use for other land use things like planning and zoning and variances, and we have that in place already. Then maybe we can just have some general language, you know, to say, and this notice process should be in compliance with whatever is being used according to land use under local government procedures now. So if you would give me the authority to do that, I would do that, and I would bring that. I'll make sure that I have a chance to talk with the members about that because I understand how important the notice provision is to all of you.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say I'm not sure, again, because this isn't something I'm as – not an area I've ever practiced in, but I think that there are some statutes, state law, that have to do with notice requirements for – you know, land changes. Maybe it's more local, but the problem is when you're in dealing with a metropolitan area or an area where you have a lot of density, you're likely to have more of those rules in place because you just, you know, we just don't have as many rules related to zoning and so forth when you get out into greater Minnesota. And you also have the situation where you have a lot of people who live away, who own hunting land or own cabins or whatever, and may not see something in a local newspaper, and that's another reason why I think you require notice to be given to surrounding landowners. Okay. So it seems to me that we should be sure that we are making people aware. And in my preference, Senator Higgins, rather than eliminating the alternative to mailing, because I think you wanted to make sure that mailing happened if someone's asked for notice. Again, I just don't feel up in our area anyone's going to even know about the need to ask for notice, and it would be so broad. you'd be talking about pretty much everyone that lives in the country being in conjunction with some kind of, you know, state land or county land. So I just like it to, I'd rather have it changed to say that you do have to do this. Something like the public body shall publish the notice once at least 10 days before the meeting in the newspaper of general circulation within the area of the public body's authority, so that there is a definite requirement of that publication. And in addition to that, the requirement to notify the affected landowners.
Well, why don't we dispose of the at least part of the amendment that seems to be in agreement, and then deal with the rest? Samrod, did you have a preference as to which part of the amendment you wanted to deal with first?
Lines 1.3 to 1.8.
Okay. Actually, 1.2 to 1.8.
Yes, Chairman.
Yeah, Senator Scheid, on that part of the amendment,
yes,
Senator Scheid.
Yes, Chairman, and Senator Moore, and with the idea that you're still going to continue to,
yes,
to work on this language, because I think you don't want to limit it just to special meetings.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Moore moves lines 1.2 to 1.8 of the A3 amendment. There's discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. Motion prevails. Lines 1.2 to 1.8 of the A3 amendment are adopted. Now we have before us lines 1.9 to 1.13. Discussion on that part of the
Mr.
amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I think Senator Olson had a great idea.
I can read that again, Mr.
Chair. And it could be in addition to the mailing,
mm-hmm,
or
Mr.
Whatever.
Chair,
okay.
If,
Senator, Senator Olson.
If we were just to delete on line 1.9 after the
quote,
if we were to delete the language all the way through on the next line, the word meetings, so we take out the whole part about it as an alternative, and then beginning with the word the last word on 1.10, if we were to capitalize that, and then say the public body instead of may, change that to a shall, publish the notice once at least 10 days before the meeting in the, and then again on line 1.2, delete all the language up to the word newspaper, the second newspaper. So it would just say in the newspaper of general circulation, or perhaps it would have to say in a newspaper of general circulation, since there may be more than one. And then just through the end of the sentence. That would be my suggestion.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I'm not adverse to your suggested language here. I have to put it on the record, and I wanted to let the members know that I am concerned about requiring local governments to have to publish because they have to pay for this. So it would depend on how many of these transactions take place. It could be de minimis if a county only does this, you know, once a year. But if there's a county that does this a lot, I don't know what the cost these days, the going cost for these publications are. So I would cautiously consider this to be a friendly amendment, but I just want to put you on notice that if the local governments come and say, we would love to do this, we just don't have the resources to do it, that you would allow me to come back to have a conversation with you, Senator Olson, to say, how else can we move forward with this? Because I don't want to impose any more, costs onto them.
Senator Olson has moved on page 1, line 9. Now, that's actually page 3, line 7. Delete the new language on line 9. Line 10, delete the new language up through the comma. So you'd start the word, this area with the word the. And then on line 12, delete the language up to the word news, prior to the word newspaper, and insert
newspaper.
The word a.
Two newspapers on that one.
Excuse me, on page 1.11, delete the word the at the end of the sentence, the second the, third the third, delete the third the and insert the word a. Page line 12, delete everything up through the word qualified.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
there's
Olson.
One more change on line 1.11 instead of may.
I'm sorry. And then, yes, okay. Word shall. Change may to shall on 1.11. So do we have that? That's the motion. Senator Scheid on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, do you have A in there? I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You do. Okay.
Change the to A on 1.11. Any discussion on the motion? Anybody want to be heard on?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Nair.
We're certainly fine with this amendment. It wasn't my intent to come in here and try and get a new publication requirement for newspapers. I was just trying to at least give minimum notice to people who don't have internet. It was not meant to feather our bed at all by any stretch. And I just, in response to the question that Senator Scheid mentioned, there actually is no current requirement in law for noticing regular meetings of county boards. They have schedules that are posted, and those are regular.
Available.
So that's why we took the language out of the special meeting notice requirement in 13D. Maybe Kathy Pines can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that there is no notice requirement. So we took the language from the special meeting notice and put that right here into.
But Mr. Chair,
we might have a chance to revisit that in a moment. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, but if it is going to be a public hearing, which it probably is, mm-hmm. there are notice requirements for public hearings separate from just a regular
right,
yes.
right.
notice.
And most of those,
so those would be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, most of those statutes for public hearings actually do require mm-hmm. notice in newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I didn't want to overstep here by suggesting that. I was trying to just propose something and what I thought was in the public interest. You certainly can go further than this and require notice to individual landowners and everything, and that's probably a very good idea. But I at least wanted to make sure that people who didn't have computers had notices of these meetings.
Sir Parasol.
I just have a comment because as Senator Moa mentioned, I have mentioned this, some of the things going on in our area. Actually, I'm in a metro township. I happen to be in one of the most southerly in Dakota County, but there's one south of me who are having more problems now. At any rate, it isn't uncommon for people living in those townships that are metro, when there's something hot going on, somebody gets a wild hair going, and they publish all kinds of things. And it's either hanging on your door when you come home, it might be in the paper tube, or it might even be in the mailbox, which the post office would really be upset about. But, you know, what are they going to do with it? Because everybody got a flyer from their township officers. Or a group that's planning a big meeting, whether they're township officers or not, but it's in response to something going on in their area. So they're pretty up to date on it. And we hardly ever miss anything because somebody always tells you about it and there's something hanging on your door.
Further discussion on the second part of the A3 amendment. Senator Olson renews her motion to amend that second part from 1.9 to 1.13. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. The second part of the A3 amendment is adopted. If we could go back to the first part, Ms. Pontius has some suggestion based upon some of the discussion we've had. Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, just to clarify that this special meeting notice applies regardless of what kind of meeting it involves. You have people that make these sort of generic requests. Anytime there's a special meeting, I want to get a notice of it, or anytime there's a meeting dealing with the subject matter. I would suggest on page 1, line 5 of the amendment, after body, insert comma, regardless of whether the matter is considered at a regular or special meeting. I think that's the intent here. And it just clarifies that if they happen to have it at a regular meeting, the special meeting notice requirements would still apply.
Okay. Does somebody wish to move that language?
I would.
Senator Scheid moves the language as read by counsel. Do you need it read again or ready to go? Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment to the amendment is adopted. Is there Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is if we're able to do an amendment that would be as vague as this, but I would like to offer an amendment either now or work with Senator Moa later that would give council the ability to incorporate the kind of language we use for variances within 350 feet of the affected property, that, you know, notice be mailed to landowners within 350 feet of the affected property. And I would, you know, expect that could happen at the same time within that same 60-day time frame that we're going to mail out the notice to those who have requested special notice. And so if I don't have to have the exact language, but we can give council the latitude to word it similar, I don't know if that's okay for
an
amendment.
Well, I think we'd like to, perhaps some research needs to be done on that too, because I don't know what some local ordinances provide. We may have state laws in here. I don't know that right now we'd be in a position to simply adopt something like that. I think we'd have to double check just to see what the requirements actually are statewide before we can proceed on that. But it's something, it's a legitimate question. I think we need to just check out what the law is before we, you know, offer something here. So,
Mr. Chair and members, I first of all, Maine, you should have confidence that I'm going to take ownership of this notice thing because it's very important to this committee. And I hope that I end up on the tax conference committee where we will have a discussion on this. What I would like to do is to have an opportunity to look at and talk to the local governments to see what processes have been established already and are in place for public hearings at the city or at the county levels. And if our local governments already have processes and procedures in place, perhaps we could make a general reference that the notice with respect to this process, you know, ought to comply with the public notice processes that are currently in place, or some general reference like that to make sure we anchor it. But I would think, and I don't want to be disrespectful to our local governments, to presume that they don't have those kind of processes in place if they do. I mean, I don't feel like we ought to be too overly prescriptive and be meddling in how they do their local processes. I think I'm fairly comfortable and confident that our local governments already have notice processes in place for their regular meetings and for their for these type of public hearing type meetings. And I like an opportunity to have a chance to talk with the local governments. And if it feels that that's not the case, then I'll work with council to put some language in here. And Senator Olson, I will personally work with you on that to your satisfaction. But I think that the committee knows that this is not something that I'm not trying to work on. But I want to be cautious about being overly prescriptive to local government that in some way might contradict a process that they already have in place.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another issue that's in this bill a couple of times that I'd like to go back to is the idea of selling property for less than its full market value. I understand the explanation that was offered, but I also know local counties boards in small populated districts are under tremendous pressures sometimes from people they know personally. They usually know everyone personally or just about everyone in the county. And a lot of pressure from developers also, and especially when jobs are scarce. And so somehow we have to have some balance in the law because from my perspective, as I think I've made it clear, I got excited as soon as I knew this was the subject of this bill, even though it may be a very good bill, just because so many people in my district care so deeply about preserving public land and just making sure that we're doing that. And I'm not saying this bill, it sounds like this bill is also concerned about that, but it's a very, very important topic for people who choose to live in an area because of the amount of public land there. So I'm just concerned that there's an opportunity, at least, or we're putting in law the possibility for increasing that pressure whenever we say that something can be purchased for less than its full market value. I can see a developer or someone who wants what would potentially be a valuable piece of land, putting pressure on a county board to try to reclassify the land and then sell it to them because of all the wonderful things it's going to do for that area. And I think one of the balances we've had before is at least by having to sell for full market value, there isn't a special reason why someone might want to target that public land for development or target it to try to move it out of the public sector. And so I just think that there's an unintended potential consequence when you're allowing that possibility.
Senator Olson, I'm looking at the language in 15.8 to 15.9. I mean, the change would still require that the land be sold to the highest bidder, although it may be sold for less than its appraised value. So, I mean, as long as you get more than one person in there, you'd still presumably get a something that's higher. But if it's only one person interested in it, as the testimony was, you know, you may have some landlocked land that's only going to affect one property owner, and the property owner is going to say, I'm not going to pay the, you know, the high the appraised value when I can use it for free. So,
Mr.
anyway,
Chair.
Sarah Higgins.
And I think that shows the differences in the geographic regions of the state because, you know, in communities like mine where the foreclosure crisis is just tanking every property value, you know, we'd be lucky to sell them for $100, some of these properties that, you know, 2 years ago probably had a house on it that sold for $200,000. And so I think that's it's often a reflection of the kind of the delay and the change at the public level of the property value and the assessment and all of that, that you know they're often much higher than what anybody could ever sell them for. But if that's the you know that's the appraised value. Or the assessed value, it's often way too high for what anybody would pay for it in communities like mine. Now, in Senator Olson's world, that is a way different thing. So it's, I think, very much of a recognition of we've got city and rural properties that are very different.
Sarah Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think this is in here. I remember it just, for example, on page 5, it's in there again on 5.15 about selling for less than full value. I would just suggest perhaps to Senator Moy that she may want to talk to some of the conservation organizations. There are many of them out there, organizations, you know, and just see if there are some concerns and some language that might help to tighten this a bit.
Senator Olson, the committee, this bill has been through the Environment Policy Committee. It was duly noticed, and no one came forward. The members of that committee gave it a very thorough vetting, particularly on the conservation land provisions. We were there for almost 2 hours, so there was a very thorough conversation. Plus, this language is supported by all the northern counties, and the county, what is the organization, the commission?
The Land Commissioners.
The League of Land Commissioners have looked at this language, and they are on board with the proposal. The reason why we have moved towards the county process is that if you look beyond the two lines that you reference, it lays out some very specific requirements that have to be met, some findings that have to be found by the county before they would allow a parcel that is non-conservation land to be sold for less than market value. And so the county board determines that a sale at a reduced price is in the public interest because the reduced price is necessary to provide an incentive to correct the blighted conditions that make the lands undesirable in the open market, or the reduced price will lead to the development of affordable housing, and it lists other requirements that has to be met in the instance of non-conservation tax forfeited land that are being sold for development other than public uses. Okay, then in terms of the non-conservation land, there's some very specific requirements for that. And the reason why we have a provision in terms of conservation land, the reason why we have a provision for it to be sold for less than market value is that usually the only people who are interested in purchasing conservation land are parks or local government or agencies like the DNR that wants the land to be put into conservation, and we don't want them to have to pay market value for it when we're actually really taking it for forestry land or parkland to preserve it. So, you know, I would invite you to maybe sit with the bill a little bit and let's continue the conversation about it. I know we're not at cross purposes here. I think that Mr. Nord was absolutely correct that there's a lot in this bill. And what I would like is I would invite you to maybe I'll have Mr. Nord come and sit down with you and go through the bill with you because I think that the stuff we have in here are very good and very balanced in our approach.
Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 1126, first in Grossman as amended? Come on forward. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Senators. Jeff Strand, I'm with the Hennepin County Taxpayer Services Department. I'm here today on behalf of Jill Alverson, Hennepin County Auditor Treasurer. I'm an administrative supervisor, and I'm responsible for the delinquent property tax enforcement, tax forfeited land administration, and also foreclosure prevention. I do have a few copies of handouts that I'd appreciate if the chair would provide to committee members.
We'll send a page around.
Thank you. And so speaking on behalf of Taxpayer Services Department today, I just want to note a few key points that in the bill, I think especially lines 5.32, 7.11, as it pertains to the targeted neighborhood provisions, which, as was noted earlier, applies to Minneapolis and St. Paul primarily. I think that it is imperative to preserve the county board's discretion on the conveyance of targeted neighborhood tax forfeit properties and retain the language that requires either recommendation or favorable recommendation on municipal requests. And that is consistent with current practice and the Hennepin County Board policy. In fact, in Hennepin County, the county and the city of Minneapolis have a memo of understanding whereby Hennepin County, based on some 2001 legislative changes that made the practice consistent across the entire state, that the county board decided that it would allow the city to take initially 10% and later 20% of the target area properties net of repurchases. So since that MOU was adopted, the county has given the city 23 parcels for $1 per parcel. Those parcels have ranged in value, and this is the quote-unquote appraised value, from $4,500 to $55,000. And the county is in the process of renegotiating an MOU specifically for targeted areas, which of course deal with lower income, higher unemployment, at least 25% of the building substandard, and it's getting at blight in a timely manner. Secondly, Hennepin County has not experienced any stalemate whatsoever over the classification of tax forfeit properties. Now, while this may be a problem in northern Minnesota counties, and I certainly respect that, having served on a task force several years ago with auditor treasurers and land commissioners dealing with the 282.018 150-foot trigger issue for public water shoreland requiring special legislation, Hennepin County has not had any stalemate issues with its municipalities, and so we had proposed to the Department of Revenue that retaining the current method or allowing those counties with problems to opt into a new process. And so we anticipate an amendment coming forward at some point that either does that or a little more burdensome on Hennepin County to have to opt into a process that is working for it presently. So as we look at it, the process currently is not broken for our county. The current classification method using municipal review affords a valuable community engagement to local residents interested in tax forfeited lands. For example, at a previous meeting with Department of Revenue staff, a City of Minneapolis Community Planning and Economic Development staff person spoke to how that city mails notices concerning the newly tax forfeit properties to the 81 neighborhood organizations in Minneapolis, providing for those neighborhood organizations review and comment prior to city council action. And I can speak from a personal basis outside of my work at Hennepin County. I am a appointee of the Minneapolis Neighborhoods and Community Engagement Commission, and so I have personal knowledge of that fact. I would like to point you also to Hennepin County's forfeiture numbers, and while we don't have 900,000 acres of land under management, thank goodness, in our county, we do annually have a reasonably large number of tax forfeiture cases. And as the person charged with foreclosure prevention and response, I can tell you that the 17,000 foreclosures in Hennepin County over the past 4 years have done a lot of damage to our county's tax base. As you all know, the human and property costs have been severe. We've also seen some trends in terms of properties pending forfeiture. And so each year my staff deal with the clients who are residing in properties that are tax forfeit. Now, I would like nothing better than to be able to go to work for Hennepin County to do something other than manage tax forfeit properties, sincerely. And a former boss said that he wanted me to work myself out of a job. Unfortunately, tax forfeiture seems to be a part of life currently. And despite our best efforts in terms of forfeiture prevention efforts, putting the foreclosure counseling notice information into the 9,000 delinquent notices for 2008 delinquent taxes, and the roughly 800 notices to taxpayers pending forfeiture in Hennepin County this year, we still see an increase year over year, about 40% the previous year, 30% this year. So we deal with all sorts of properties from the one-foot strip that is valueless to the polluted industrial site in my career, and I have worked in this field since 1985. Hennepin County has acquired 4 permanent list of priority sites, 4 Minnesota Superfund sites, 2 federal Superfund sites. And so the county has a contaminated lands restoration program, has a program to collaborate with the affordable housing development community to look at a very niche program that utilizes small business enterprise and minority contractors to do work on building better neighborhoods and providing permanent affordable housing. And so I think the discretion of the county board is important, and I believe that is preserved in terms of the rationale for providing affordable housing and to remove blight in the new proposal. Lastly, as I mentioned, we have in Hennepin County 1,300 historic public use parcels, which we do track on our computer. And I have had the opportunity over the years to work with Mr. Sturica and others at the department and with the DNR on the occasional misstep by a city. I recall in Northwest Hennepin, a city sold a lakeshore lot for $180,000 and then unfortunately discovered later, the auditor's office actually discovered that the conditional use deed had a trigger, had a reversion clause, and so that did require special legislation and hundreds of hours of work on the part of many people. So I think having better language on the conditional use deeds will be an improvement, and we have been involved with the Department of Revenue on those meetings. I want to commend the leadership of the department for involving the counties and especially involving Hennepin, Ramsey, Minneapolis, and St. Paul in the discussions. Thank you.
Mr. Strand, just to clarify, are you in support of the legislation, opposed to it, have some concerns about it? Because I'm not quite sure. Where is the county on this?
I can only speak for the county auditor's office, and I don't believe the county board has taken a formal position. The auditor treasurer's office, which is responsible, and in Hennepin County, the board has delegated its legal authority and responsibility under 282 to the administrator and auditor treasurer. So there are good aspects of the bill, and the taxpayer services has been involved with revenue. I'm saying that some of the tightening of the conditional use deed provisions, I would say in our experience, is a good thing. I am hopeful that there will be some amendment that allows those counties which do not have a problem with the current classification method, where the system is not broken, to continue to use the current method, and in fact, perhaps not even to have to opt into the existing, which will be the new. May I say one other thing, Mr. Chairman, regarding the notice? And I apologize.
Please, go ahead. I did ask for go ahead.
I can ask our other legislative staff person if he has a more formal opinion.
Mr. Chair, I have to say that everything that Hennepin County has problems with, I have already resolved in the delete everything amendment that we put on the bill.
Okay.
And if Hennepin County would just stay in touch with the author of this bill, and if Hennepin County would just pay attention to the emails and notification communications that revenue has been sending to them, Hennepin County would not have to waste their money to send somebody here to testify with concerns about what's in the bill, because we specifically took care of them in the language in the bill. And I didn't even know that Hennepin County was going to come and testify today, or else I would have communicated this information to them.
Anybody else want to be heard? Thank you, Mr. Strand. Anybody else want to be heard on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, may I have one final sentence, and that is regarding the tax forfeiture. I'm sure the committee members realize that we're not dealing with just vacant land parcels. We're dealing with homeowners. We're dealing with distressed homeowners. Oftentimes, we have between 2 to 3 cases of clutter homes. And so I do have some concerns about publishing those home addresses and names in a newspaper of general circulation at the time of the first classification. So I just, that just came up today during your committee discussion, that I think there could be some unforeseen consequences in terms of publishing that new list in a general newspaper when we have distressed homeowners that we're trying to work with to be able to repurchase their properties.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, are you talking about the reclassification?
Yes, Senator Scheid. I'm talking about the publishing of the classification or reclassification that is done upon the new forfeiture of properties. Typically, Hennepin classifies properties 2 to 3 times annually. And we have roughly, we had 101 properties, 61 buildings forfeit last year.
Any questions of Mr. Strand? Does anybody else want to be heard on Senate File 1126, first engrossment as amended? Sir Ma?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 1126 as amended be recommended to pass.
Discussion on that motion. Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. And you can see what happens when the Senate Judiciary Committee is well rested. I pity the person who has the first bill in the 2010 session, 2010 session. With that, the meeting is adjourned.